about these five pillars of connected systems. So I figured we could talk about that some.
So,
do we want to close the door?
No.
Okay, cool. Let's just see who walks by.
So who are you?
I'm Harry Christian. I'm an architect for the architecture strategy team. I'm, which is funny because I'm actually on the marketing team inside the architecture strategy team. So I don't know how many other marketing teams at Microsoft have architects on them, but this is one. So.
So I didn't know we had an architecture strategy team.
It's in your division.
Well, I knew it. The viewers do. But so what do you guys do?
our responsibility, so we're part of our developer and platform evangelism, just like you are. And as towards that, part of what we do is we're responsible for being able to address the architect audience. And architect is it's a pretty big audience. It's probably a lot bigger than you think. I think some of our sizing studies sort of showed at like 600,000 people who engage at least part-time in architecture activities in the U.S. alone. So it's a pretty significant audience. And of course, a lot of these architects are in, you know, pretty high-level, senior decision-making kinds of positions. Not all, as it turns out, obviously, but...
CTOs and stuff?
Yeah, CTOs, that's typically the sort of the grouping, you know, CTO and architect. A lot of times there's an architect that's supporting a CTO. Sometimes the architect is filling the CTO role, sometimes they're separate. It's sort of a decision, you know, from an organization perspective, you know, how technical, how, you know, involved in sort of the business. My personal view on architecture is that it's sort of the translation between what the business needs and what IT does, if you will, right? So that sort of translation, in fact, if you look at building architecture and, you know, construction, that's primarily the role of the architect, to go between the people who are actually doing the building, engineers and stuff, and the customer, which in this case is the business. You know, the reality is the term architecture has, you know, wide ranging. I just got back from TechEd, so if you saw this joke at TechEd, you know, bear with me, you've heard it before. But we call the guy at the, you know, at the big Fortune 500 corporation who makes strategic decisions about, you know, platform and application portfolio, we call that guy an architect. And at least a significant amount of the time, we call the guy that makes the decision between using a linked list and an array, we sometimes call him an architect too. And so that's a pretty big, you know, area to trying to address. And so we actually divide the space up into sort of three levels of architects. And again, I'm not quite sure architecture is the right word for all of this, but that's, you know, what the, you know, that's what the industry uses. So, you know, we sort of have to go along with that.
Yeah.
So we have sort of the strategic enterprise or business architect. We have solution or software kind of architects and infrastructure architects.
Right.
So, you know, if you imagine, you know, the kind of infrastructure it takes to run a large scale system like the email system at Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
The lifeblood of Microsoft. Xbox Live, MSN, right? I mean, these are, you know, there are a lot of architectural decisions that go into setting up that kind of infrastructure.
Well, in the news this week, we're replacing all the Wi-Fi terminals or the Wi-Fi outlets worldwide. So that's a pretty big...
At Microsoft. Okay, I didn't see that news.
It's one of the biggest Wi-Fi networks in the world.
Right, so how do you design that Wi-Fi network, right? What are the... Again, if you go back to architecture is the meaning of business and IT, what's the business need? Right, I mean, we're not just deploying Wi-Fi for the fun of it. Well, I mean, maybe it's for my fun, your fun. I mean, the reality is, you know, it's a productive thing to be able to walk into a meeting space and to be able to immediately be online. You know, that's a very valuable business productivity gain, right? And so the design of that, there's, you know, architectural pieces of that, you know, from a, you know, how does it interact with the business? There are more engineering kind of focused things, like how are we going to get, you know, X amount of coverage over Y amount of space.
Yeah.
And then there's the people who actually, you know, install the boxes.
Now tell me a little bit about yourself, because I'm trying to figure out the kind of skills you need to be an architect. And
all of
certainly,
them.
Certainly,
I certainly don't have all of them.
Well,
I don't even have all of them.
You're not just an architect. You're like the architect's architect, right? You're teaching other architects about architecture.
Well, it's funny. My business card, and I made a big hoo-ha about this when I first got my business card on my blog, but. I'm an architect with a lowercase a, and it's not a typo, it's on purpose, because, I mean, the reality is, I mean, we have a lot to learn around architecture, right? I mean, this group, the architecture strategy group, has only been around for 4 or 5 years, right? I mean, it's not like enterprise architecture started 4 or 5 years ago. It's getting more serious over time. But the reality is, I mean, this stuff's been, you know, around and important for decades.
Yeah.
So it's been around and important as long as computers have been around. In fact, one of the view that we take of business is that business has a series of capabilities, and these capabilities are, you know, implemented as people, procedures, and technology.
Yeah.
So you could theoretically take this view into an entirely manually run business that doesn't have computer one, right? Granted, I wouldn't want to work at that business. Go figure. Yeah. But I mean, that's those kind of architectural principles of how you run your business, how you organize your, you know, business, how you make money. I mean, these things are sort of not necessarily specific to computers. And, you know, we've been in this space for, you know, 4 or 5 years. So, you know, I think we actually do. If you look at where we are in, say, business productivity, I mean, office productivity or developer productivity, you know, we are a much bigger name in those parts of the industry relative to where we are in architecture. With architecture, we're doing a lot more listening than talking still, I think. I mean, we got some really great, interesting things to say.
Now, tell me about your family, because your dad worked at IBM, right?
No, my father worked at Bell Labs.
Oh, wow.
Right, so he helped invent this little thing called Unix, you might have heard of. He also helped create a language called C, which you might have also heard of. Of course, I'm not sure I'd be putting him on the spot. I can't ever remember.
He has a blog too, right?
He has a blog. He does. I keep trying to get him to blog. He doesn't do very much.
Well, so. Maybe this video will get him to post a few more.
Well, he's getting a lot of. I did a webcast on the Guidance Automation Toolkit a couple weeks ago, and he listened in. So he asked a question, and Tom from Patterns and Practices popped up, and he was the one reading the questions off. He goes, "Is this guy related to you? Hal Pearson?" I'm like, "Yeah, that's my dad." He's actually an architect for the Federal Aviation FAA. I forget. Federal Aviation Association. I don't remember what.
So this runs in the family, though. Architect gene and passed down.
Well, I've certainly been working with computers. You know, for somebody who's in his mid-30s, I could get any more accurate than that, I guess. To have been working with computers, you know, for literally 20 years or so, 25 years. Obviously, when I was 10, I was playing around, but I mean, I cut my teeth on a VT100 terminal and a telecoupled 300 baud modem. Actually, before that, we had a paper terminal. Granted, I was playing games. I was 10, right? I mean, it wasn't like I was, but that's what this whole thing started. Is we were playing Adventure, you know, the precursor to Zork, which was, you know, essentially one of the very first text-based adventure games. And I said, I want to learn how to write these. And, you know, 20 some odd years later, here I am, and you're interviewing me.
Yeah.
There's a few things that happen in between.
Now, there's a book on your desk called Software Factories, right?
Yes.
And that sort of hints at the changes that have happened in the 20 years you've been playing with computers in terms of architecture, right?
Well, yeah, so Factories is a book by a couple of guys in the Visual Studio team, Jack Greenfield, who came over from Rational, and Keith Shore, and a couple of other guys from the Domain-Specific Language Toolkit team in Cambridge, Steve Cook and Stuart Kent. And I mean, collectively, these guys know a ton about modeling. I mean, Jack, as an example, used to be, I think he was he was an architect or a lead on Rational's XDE product. And XDE is the Rational's integration of Visual Studio and UML. So these are guys who know tons about UML and have done all kinds of this kind of modeling stuff. And so Factories is a concept around sort of bringing more automation to computer software development. I'll give you an example. I don't know where you live, but currently I live...
Bothell.
Okay, so I live in a neighborhood up on the plateau called Klehane. And Klehane is this massive... I mean, it's like there's 100 homes in just our little neighborhood. And I know that because we lost our cat once, and luckily she's okay. But, you know, we went around and put, you know, things on every door. I didn't even realize how many houses there were. And so Klehane has like 20 neighborhoods, so it's just this huge neighborhood. And when you build a neighborhood like that, right, you tend to have all the houses in the neighborhood look basically the same.
Yeah.
Right? And the reason for that is that you can really save a lot by doing things the same over and over again. Not every house isn't identical. They're not all in the same spot. They don't all face the same direction. There are little differences. They're painted different colors. They've got slightly different floor plans. This one has different cabinetry than the next one. But because they are so similar, you can save a lot. I mean, the reason that people build houses like this is because it is a lot cheaper to build them that way than it is to build them one-off, right? Yeah. Which is how houses used to be built. Well, that's essentially the game we're talking about with software factories. When you hear the term factory, and there's been a lot of debate about the term factory, you think about the idea of we're going to stamp out 18 bazillion of the same thing over and over again. Like, like the way Microsoft, you know, hires companies to stamp out Xboxes and CDs, or you know, the computer companies hire, you know, to do computers. Every single Toshiba laptop is this, you know, in the same series of anyway, is the same as the next.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of mentality around a factory. But what we're talking about is economies not of scale, which is we're going to do the same thing over and over again, but economies of scope, which is to say we're doing a bunch of things that are very, very similar. They're each unique, but we can save a bunch of time and money by doing things, by leveraging the fact that these things are mostly the same.
Interesting.
And so, for example, we build every web app today as if it were the first web app of its kind ever created.
Right.
And so you start a Visual Studio and you say, I want to create a new web app. It gives you essentially, you know, a blank page, right?
So is this the new form of templates or the new form of
factories?
Or?
Factory's a concept,
okay.
Right? So it's, I mean, we at Microsoft are building a set of tools that sort of address this. And, you know, there's other people get whole caught up in the, is this a factory? Is not this not a factory? I basically figure that in a few years, we're going to look back at the way we build technology right now, build applications, and say, we don't build applications like that anymore. And the reality is, if we look back 5 years from now, in the year 2000, you know, we don't build applications like that, at least on the Microsoft side. The Java guys are still doing things, and you know, most of the same. Those, you know, obviously the .NET technologies weren't out in 2000. So programming in C# against the .NET framework, that's all very different than it was 5 years ago. 5 years before that, you know, VB was not really, it hadn't really gotten started. So we were doing a lot of stuff in C++. So, you know, if you look back in these five-year increments, you sort of see that software development evolves. And so we think software factories is an evolutionary step in the construction of software, which is, you know, we want to take the stuff that's the same every time and automate it and leave the developer to spend the time doing the interesting creative stuff rather than the boring, repetitive stuff that you have to do every time, right? Almost every web app has to talk to a database. Yet when you create, this blank database template, this blank web app template in Visual Studio, does it have any connections to the database setup? No. Do you have to write all that stuff? Yeah. Are there some wizards and tools to help you? Sure. But the idea is to be able to, you know, our implementation of factories, which falls into sort of two camps today. One is called domain-specific languages, and the other is called guidance automation. And we have toolkits for both of these. The guidance automation toolkit is basically a very sort of template type of system. It's much more contextual than the current templating tools. So I can basically say, in this template, there's a folder called data access logic, and there's another folder called business logic. When I go to say I want to create a new piece of business logic, it provides me different choices than when I want to create a new piece of data access logic. And so it helps guide me by reducing the number of choices that I actually have, which is one of the ways you get productivity, right? If you've got this huge blank slate, you've got to figure out what to do next. If the tool can help guide you and say, you put business access, business logic here, you put data access logic there, then that's one less thing that the person who's building the system has to figure out. Not that there isn't any creativity left in the process. There's obviously tons. Every web app is different from the next. But, you know, they tend to be more similar than different. And yet we treat them as if each is their own unique. We build them as if each is the first one ever created.
Interesting.
So I do a lot of stuff with factories personally. I believe very strongly in a factories approach. And actually not only to software, but also to business. Because if you think about it from a business perspective, you take Microsoft, you moved up here relatively recently. You know, Microsoft employees were not responsible for your move. That's all outsourced.
Yeah.
Right? That whole process, where were you staying when you got up here, the movers, the whole organization process, we just outsourced that. Why? Because it's not a core competency of this company. The people who run the cafeteria and stock the free Cokes in the kitchen, that's also outsourced because it's not a core competency of this company. And so you start to think about what are the things that this company does that are the same as every other company, and then what are the things that we do that are different? And those are the things that Microsoft and any company needs to focus on. So you can actually take the same kind of factories approach to business as well. So that's one of the things I spend a lot of time thinking about. So when will this air, out of curiosity?
God knows.
Would it be at least, say, 2 weeks from today?
We can hold it if you need to hold it.
Well, the only thing I wanted to say about that is I'm actually getting ready to switch roles. But I want to blog it on my blog before it shows up on C9. So.
Okay.
I'm actually leaving the marketing team, so I'm pretty excited about that. I'm actually going to go work for John Davidoff, who's one of the two directors of architecture on this team. And this is what I'm going to spend a lot of my time thinking about, actually, is, you know, what's our whole story? How can we do a better job telling it? We've got great, you know, we have great action, we've got great characters, we've great elements of a story, but we don't really have the whole thing sort of tied together end to end. And so that's one of the things I'll be focusing on.
Now, I on my travels, I've met a lot of CTOs over the last couple of weeks. So, you know, I met the guy who runs Hearst Media, for instance, which is Hearst Media.
Hearst Media, okay.
You might have heard of them.
Yeah.
And another guy who runs, helps run the BBC. So you might have heard them too.
Yeah, I actually met some of those guys when they were over here once.
But they tell me all their woes, right? Which are, they have existing systems. How do you move an existing, you know, business that might have a few systems built on Linux and a few systems built on Windows, and they're cobbled together and they're using technology that was bought 8 years ago? How do you move them into this new software factory world?
Well, there's a couple.
You know, if you had the CTO, why move? You know, what's the business?
So there's,
you know, why invest in IT, I guess, is the question. You know?
Well, I mean, it's funny. I ranted about that at the time that IT doesn't matter thing came out. I actually don't like calling it IT. I like calling it TI, technology infrastructure. And TI doesn't matter that much, right? I mean, granted, you know, I'm working in an architecture group at a platform company, right? So, you know, when we talk about things like databases and directory services, Microsoft makes databases and directory services, and I typically use, you know, SQL and Active Directory as examples. But a lot of the stuff we talk about is at a level of abstraction where, this stuff runs in the database, but if it was Oracle or SQL, a lot of these same architectural concepts apply. Now, you know, I'm a Microsoft employee, and I think it's a lot faster, easier, and cheaper to do on the Windows platform than on any of our competitors. I'm slightly biased on that front, as it turns out, but, you know, that's my personal opinion. Is a lot of the stuff comes down to actually implementing it is easier on our platform, but from a conceptual or architectural perspective, it isn't necessarily radically different, right? If you think about, I need a place to store data that supports transactions, well, SQL does that, DB2 does that, Oracle does that. So it's not like if that's the piece that you need, that those are functionally, you know, very different tools. Of course, the way you actually accomplish that is very different from tool to tool, and that is where a lot of the value comes from. But I'm always one to tell customers, look, if something's working, you shouldn't just change it, right? As much as we'd like you to buy lots of our stuff and replace all that other competitor technology, that'd be great. The reality is you got to do this stuff sort of piecemeal, right? One of the things that it's funny, actually, going to work for John. John is a very pragmatic guy. What can we do now, next, today? And I tend to be a sort of, what are we going to be doing in 5 years? Because if you don't really know what you're doing in 5 years, it's hard to make the right steps today towards that end. And working for John is going to be great because John will help sort of infuse me with some of that. Well, but what are we going to do about that today? Right, we're going to be doing all this great stuff in 5 years, but you know, how do we get there from here? Microsoft's investing very heavily in web services, which is obviously a very, you know, technology, platform-neutral way of approaching connected systems. Because we realize, you know, it may take us a while sometimes, you know, but we realize the importance of being able to connect to all that Linux and Java and mainframe and all that kind of stuff.
And Sun.
Well, yeah. Unix, yeah. Sun, BEA, IBM.
All the stuff your dad works on.
It's funny. He always likes to say, yeah, we had that in Unix. Like, multi-threading? Oh, we had that years ago. Yeah, okay, great, Dad, thanks. He's pretty deep on this stuff too. It makes for interesting conversations over Christmas at dinner time, right? So, oh, they're going at it.
Can you film those for a channel?
Next time he's out here, I'll get you. You can interview him too.
All right.
Consent, that is, which I assume he will. So
yeah.
He reads your blog.
Yeah, thanks.
He even blogged when you blogged about his blog.
Yep. Self-referential blog.
Yeah. I blogged him, you blogged him, he was excited about it. Anyway, the important thing is to look for, you know, where are you spending the most amount of effort and time today, and what can you do to solve that? If you go back to the sort of the view of the business as, you know, business is a set of capabilities that, you know, are implemented, people, process, or technologies.
Yep.
If you have a process that's very repetitive, that's driven by people and process and has no technical automation, that's a great opportunity to sort of save money and time and effort by investing in some piece to make that capability be automated, to make that faster and cheaper. That's a very pragmatic view, and that's, you know, the only view you can really take. I mean, if you've got, it's great to think about, oh, in 5 years, if we had a totally greenfield, we'd do this. But it's not particularly realistic.
Yeah, when I was in the London train station, I was looking at all the computers, and they're all running Windows XP, but they're all running a DOS app, you know, character mode app. And yeah. Same thing at Hertz, right? Hertz has all, you know, down in Oakland, you know, when you're at the counter, and it's all brand new Windows XP machines, but it's running a DOS, a pretty ugly DOS screen.
Right. So, I mean, so this stuff, anything like this evolves over time. What are the key differences between architecture in terms of IT from, say, building architecture is that this stuff changes much more quickly, right? I mean, this building that we're sitting in used to house the office team. Right now it houses our team and a variety of other teams. Or I don't know what part of the office guys were here. But, you know, and there are certain things that change over time. You know, you guys just installed the plasma screen over by the elevators, and, you know, the air conditioning system will wear out, and the elevators will need to be upgraded. And, you know, those kind of things will all happen. And obviously we've moved different people in, and maybe sometimes you say, gee, it'd be really great if we had this much one bigger conference room, or we take an existing conference room and shred it into smaller bits, and that kind of stuff. So these kind of evolutions occur, but in information space it happens much more quickly. You know, and it's important from a business perspective. The analogy I always like to use, which Pat Helland used to talk about, or I assume he still talks about it, he's just gone on to a different company, is UPS and Starbucks. UPS is the shipping department for Starbucks. Now, I imagine that when UPS came into being, they didn't expect to be in the business of outsourced shipping department, but it's a business opportunity they have today because it's a capability that they can provide. And it's not really... Again, you go back to sort of core competencies. Is that really Starbucks' core competency? No. Could they hire drivers and buy trucks? Sure. But would they be able to do it less expensively than UPS can do it? No. Because UPS already has all the infrastructure. They're already driving through the same neighborhoods where the Starbucks are, delivering a variety of other packages. So that whole opportunity, you know, it is an evolutionary process. So UPS had to change and evolve in order to be able to take advantage of that kind of an opportunity. So, you know, they tend to be very business driven. So, I mean, with me, I, as much as I'm a technologist, you know, I'm not as the biggest gadget freak on the team, but maybe in the top five, right? So, I'm a big fan of technology. I still write a lot of code. Granted, it's not as much as I used to, but I still do. But the reality is, you can't make technology decisions for technology's sake. You make them for business sake. And so that's what I would say to these CIOs who've got this existing system is, where are your pain points? And then that's the pieces you address first.
Yeah.
And by the way, what are they so that we know what we should be writing about? Obviously, we talk to a lot of these guys in order to be able to figure out what we do next. Right? Because one of the things we want to be able to do, and you know, obviously we want to listen. That's a key piece of what we're doing. But then also, you know, where can we add value? Where can we add new thinking? One of the huge benefits of actually being sort of new in the space, in my opinion, is that we're not sort of, you know, laden down with some of the older type of thinking. So we, you know, sort of brings a fresh outlook. You know, sometimes you'll ask an outsider, you know, an answer to a question kind of thing, and they'll provide you with fresh viewpoint.
What are the business drivers you're hearing from these guys? You know, you talk about talking with a lot of them. Well, is it the always on, always connected workforce that, you know, Wi-Fi brings you? I mean, I was using Wi-Fi all over Europe, you know?
Yeah, well,
and that didn't exist 3 or 5 years ago, you know?
You know, I would say that from a one of the big things is mergers and acquisitions, really, is one of the key drivers today, right? I mean, how you can run your own sales force, these are critical issues, too. I don't mean to say one is really more important than the other, but when one company buys another, and we're seeing, you know, not just like, you know, I was just talking about this with somebody today, and it's not just like stuff like, you know, a big company buys a small company, but like, you know, AT&T and Singular merge, right? I mean, that's a big, big deal, right? And you're talking about entirely duplicate infrastructure, right? I mean, down to, in the case of AT&T and Singular, I mean, down to radio towers, right? HR systems, payroll systems, management of, you know, the provisioning systems for the phones. I mean, all this stuff is all duplicated. Now, how do you go through and sort of, you know, figure out, you know, where we're duplicating the amount of effort and where can we take and change and evolve? Those are really hard problems to solve. And a lot of, again, this is stuff that's business driven. You know, I think there's a lot of opportunity. When you talk about things like the opportunity of Wi-Fi, you're talking about a technology that is driving an opportunity in business. The same way that if you go back to the UPS scenario, the connectedness of, you know, that the internet brings us provides us the opportunity to easily sort of cross the company boundaries. You go from Starbucks to UPS back to Starbucks, and you know, where does one company end and the other begin? It doesn't really matter. It's a supply chain. That kind of an opportunity would have been very difficult to do prior to the internet, right? That kind of connectivity it would have been very difficult. So there are some opportunities that are driven by changes in technology, but I think a lot of what I spend my time thinking about are what are the business problems that can be addressed with technology more than the other way around.
Yeah.
So not that there isn't room for both, it's just that's what I tend to spend my time on.
Yeah.
So
in the acquisition world, how is technology answering that question? I mean, you probably have two disparate systems.
Exactly.
Like one running on SAP, one running on Siebel, or one...
Right.
You know, and how do you merge the two together? I mean, that seems to be something that a lot of the CTOs are struggling with or talking about.
Right, I mean, to take the example you were talking about a minute ago, right, we've gone from having one large, disparate IT system with lots of different technologies that were bought sometimes as much as 20 or 30 years ago, to having two completely duplicate sets of technologies, some of which is new, some of which is old, and we now have, it isn't just mergers and acquisitions. I talked to a customer a few months ago that has like 20 ERP systems because of the various mergers and acquisitions they've done. But it, you know, how do you start to say, well, you know, we want to shut this one down and evolve it to this one? There's no, you know, there's no magic bullet for that, unfortunately, right? So there's no easy way to approach that. But it's a, as I said, it tends to be a business decision. So how do I, you know, where is this costing me the most? If I've got an SAP and a Siebel implementation, you know, maintaining both of those systems is a very, you know, costly type of case. So, you know, which one is more appropriate going forward? I'm not really going to be in a position to vote on that without, you know, more information about the actual business.
Yeah.
And it's very, you know, and for one company it might be, you know, one, for one company it might be the other. But over time, you have to be able to sort of address these needs. And so IT is in the business of doing, you know, providing new business opportunities, but also for reducing costs. And so a lot of the, those, when you do a merger and acquisition, obviously you're doing a lot of, you know, redundancy elimination.
What's the consequences of making the wrong decision?
Well, one of the consequences always of making the wrong decision, right? I mean, that's a tough question to answer. Just put me on the spot. That's helpful. It depends on the decision, right? I mean, what was the consequences of Microsoft releasing Bob, right? That was obviously not the right decision. You know, certainly that's been not the most successful product launch Microsoft's ever had. But, you know, did it harm the company? Did it, you know, are we in worse off today than we would have been if it had been a rousing success? Yeah, who knows? It depends on the scope of the decision, right? I mean, I'd like to be able to say, you know, picking .NET is the sure answer and picking anything else is a bad idea, but, you know, from a practical perspective, I don't honestly believe that. I think that if I was going to go into market, if I was going to leave Microsoft, I would want to go work for a business. I wouldn't want to go work for another technology company. Part of that is just because I love working here and I couldn't imagine it would be any more fun doing this somewhere else. And part of it is because I'd like to apply what I know in a business type of scenario. And as opposed to like being a consultant, a technology consultant, something like that.
Yeah.
And the reality is that if I was going to go into market to compete against, you know, existing players, right, in whatever industry, you know, I would do it built on the Windows platform. Partially because I know it, but partially because I believe in the agility of the Windows platform. I would do certain things around connected systems because I would believe that would provide me an opportunity to both compete better, evolve quickly, and deal with mergers and acquisitions better if we got to the point where I was either getting bought out or I was buying somebody else out. Obviously, I'd rather be the latter than the former, but you know, we'll see what actually happens if I ever leave Microsoft. So, if my wife's watching, I'm not making any plans. Don't worry.
Or your boss.
Well, I have a new boss. No, my wife seems to be much more concerned about that than anything else. I make a joke about, hey, I talked to these really great customers. I talked to a customers who really, really got it around sort of how their technology evolves and how they're dealing with data. I was like, you know, this is the kind of company I want to go work for. And my wife's like, so what, we're moving? No. No, I'm talking conceptually here. I'm not saying we're moving, believe me. So we like it here anyway. So.
What have been some of the architecture successes? Who do you look up to, or what? You know, I don't know. Let's just leave it there. Who's doing some of the most interesting thinking on architecture today?
Well, I mean, there's a lot. I'll give you an example of a company I tend to look up to quite a bit is Dell, right? I mean, if you were going to talk about a company that really does a great job of real-time business intelligence and agility, changing to a market, you know, adapting to a market, Dell does a great job of that kind of stuff, right? The way that they manage their supply chain is very impressive. The way that they deal with their data, the way that they have real-time access and can make real-time decisions, and have really pushed a lot of decision-making out to the periphery rather than trying to, you know, cycle it all through the center. I think that's a really a great example of a kind of company that, you know, really drives a lot of these kind of thinking, right? And again, you know, you can make a lot of discussion about, you know, obviously Dell runs a lot of their stuff on Microsoft, but the reality of their success, I think, comes from the way they manage their supply chain more than anything else.
Yeah.
Right. Granted, they've got a great platform that drives those systems that manage that supply chain, but it gives them an advantage, I believe, in the marketplace to build on top of the Windows platform. But the success comes from the way they manage their business more than anything else. And, you know, I used to be a pure geek, right? I used to be pure, you know, code, dev, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I look at nowadays. You know, that's part of the picture. I assume you read John Picaro's blog from, if I mispronounce his name. If I have, John, I'm sorry.
Picaro? I don't know.
He blogged the other day about something that Steve Picaro said about, you know,
Steve Ballmer,
yeah, I'm sorry.
There's a couple Steves in this industry.
That's true. It's not like I know Steve. So I presented to the Bellevue County School District or something, and they said, yeah, we had Steve come by once. I'm like, well, that helps. Great. I got to follow that out. He said something that John talked about on his blog about, you know, sell what you build, but build what you can sell, right? And that's a very, you know, prior to being, that's one of the things that's been great about working on a marketing team is the fact that you really sort of get a sense of that aspect of it, is that it's not just about building great stuff. It's building great stuff that people really need and can use and addresses real problems. And so that's, again, that to me is the sort of, you know, what's the business driver for this stuff? As opposed to, yeah, the Windows platform is, you know, X much faster or Y times easier or whatever than, you know, the next leading brand. I look at it from a position of what are the business decisions and what are the platform that's going to most effectively and allow me to take advantage of those decisions. As I said, that's a one-horse race in my opinion, but I'm biased.
Yeah.
So.
What else would I want to know about architecture?
Is this how you always do this? You just sort of walk in, you have no idea what you're really going to ask?
It's the best job in the world because I don't have to... I just have to keep up to date on what's going on in the world and seeing. You know, I mean, I talked to the Target guys and met with their CTO, and some of the drivers that they're seeing is better display technology and RFID.
So there's some guys who do a bunch of RFID in this group. In fact, the Microsoft Xbox RFID stuff was a lot of. We helped out with some of that stuff. In fact, if you'd gone to TechEd. You would have gotten. We actually had RFID tags for all the
badges.
All the badges, yeah. And I'm not. They weren't like. You know, they were all random, right? So we didn't. You know, we were just sort of experimenting with the technology. But you know, we helped out with quite a bit of that stuff. So a guy on my team, you should go talk to him, Javed.
Yeah. Are they going to do the same thing at the PDC?
I don't know. Are they going to?
A lot of people. I saw a lot of blogs about that. That people thought it was cool that they could.
Is that coming out of your guys' side of the house? We'd be happy to talk to you about that stuff.
All right.
So it's actually interesting to see the difference between like PDC and TechEd, because I just got back from TechEd.
Yeah.
And I'm a track owner. I have been at least for the last 2 years with TechEd, the architecture track owner. So.
Yeah. What's funny is you're the 5 year out guy, but TechEd's about the here and the now, right?
You know? Well, yeah, but
or the next 6 months, you know.
But again,
the PDC is usually about the next. Big platform, you know, the next big thing.
Which is funny. And it's funny about that because, first of all, I'm not the five-year guy. There's a lot of five-year guys in Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
So I don't want to lay claim to that title. That's how I think, but it's not, you know, I don't have a, you know, I don't own that from a...
How do you beat 5-year guy anyways? In today's world, it's changing so fast. You know, how do you see accurately enough beyond a year and a half? You know, a year and a half, you know, if you're well-connected in the industry and you know people like at Cisco and at Intel and, you know...
Microsoft.
Well, inside Microsoft, yeah. But if,
well, yeah.
If you have good visibility in the industry of what the drivers are going on, you can sort of see a year and a half out. But out of that, the world gets really fuzzy to me. It's really hard to predict what's going to happen.
Well, I wouldn't. That's part of the reason.
3 years or 5 years out.
It's part of the reason I wouldn't claim to be the 5-year guy, right? I mean, I tried to look that far ahead, but I didn't say I was successful at it.
Yeah.
What's funny about this stuff is that stuff. Those kind of predictions tend to either be way off, either way short or way long. Like, for example, domain-specific languages are a piece of software factories. And how long will it take for that to get adopted? I have no idea, right? So I'd say 5 years or whatever, you know, if I were to predict, which I'm not willing to for that. Right? Either it's going to happen a lot faster than that because Microsoft is pushing this kind of technology, so maybe, you know, a year or two from now, and that's what people are talking about. Or... you know, maybe it takes a lot longer to get adopted. So, I mean, it's funny how these things, you know, a lot of times they actually, the problem with making predictions 5 years out is that the technology evolves so quickly, the reality is it's actually here in 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're talking about x64-bit computing. Do you think we would have been talking about that really 5 years ago? Probably not. You know, in 2000, it's not like 64-bit was on anybody's real radar.
Yeah.
But suddenly now it's here and you
can... But in 64-bit, it's a... It's something that you sort of expect as part of an ongoing evolution.
How about multi-core? That's maybe a better example, right? Yeah. I mean, was multi-core really on a whole lot of... I mean, I imagine it was on Intel and AMD's roadmap, but, you know, generally to the industry, is that on a lot of people's radar more than, say, a year and a half ago? Probably not.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are some things that come, you know, and so it's not really a question of... That's part of the reason I use the look back 5 years as opposed to looking forward 5 years, right? Because, you know, when you look at, say, where things are going to be in 5 years, as you say, that's a guess, it's a prediction. The reality is you're going to try and guess where things are going to be in 5 years, and then you're going to evolve that over time as things change. So if uptick of domain-specific language, you know, adoption goes higher, then, you know, these things in the software factory's vision will change at this rate rather than at that rate. And so it changes the model. All Microsoft can really do is continue to ship great tools and great underlying platform for addressing these needs and continuing to react as the market reacts.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's yeah. For all the belief that marketing is magic, it's not, right? I mean, it's a lot of it is we think it's going here. I mean, take web services for example, right? Web services, you know, we first started talking about it 5 years ago, and yet we're still sort of in the process of shipping the infrastructure for it.
Yeah.
I think that's taken a lot longer than anybody would have really expected.
Yeah.
Maybe the guys who do that for a living, right? Those guys, the guys who actually do the WSR specs, they probably realized it would take this long.
And in the meantime, blogs have come out.
Yeah.
You know, nobody even thought 5 years ago about blogging right. was going to be important.
Or more importantly, the interoperability of the RSS as an XML format.
Yeah.
Right. You talk about, and what's funny about that actually is we talk about sort of the, that's actually a really interesting analogy between like the way we specify, say, WS star specifications, security, reliable messaging, what have you, versus the RSS, which was a de facto standard that people, a lot of people started using it, so therefore a lot of people were using it.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, the DARE has written a lot of stuff about the idea of ATOM instead of RSS, and, you know, from my perspective, the only benefit ATOM gives you over RSS is it has a namespace for the instead of using the default.
There's a couple others. The strictness of it.
Yeah,
requires you to give a GUID to each post so that you don't get duplicates.
Yeah, I haven't read it in depth, yeah. So but I mean, it seems
and
to be
it
pretty.
Also supposedly supports multiple enclosures, and, you know.
Yeah.
But edge cases, you know, most people are going, you know, most sites are going to be just fine with RSS. But we'll see how it evolves.
But then,
I mean, Microsoft is definitely...
But so that's interesting, right? So if you think about from a, you know, from that perspective, what are the things that are going to be standardized by committee?
Yeah.
Like WS star. What are the things that are going to be standardized by a dominant market player? In this case, you know, for blogs, obviously it was UserLand.
Yeah.
It's hard to predict, really, right? So, you know, if you say, you know, for sort of, you know, we're talking about RFID, we were talking about Target before, obviously, in this country, Walmart drives a lot of the or anything around retailing, you know, because of its size, Walmart is the de facto standard. If Walmart does it, then you have to do it too if you want to get your stuff stolen at Walmart. And if you're another company that wants to sell stuff, then doing stuff the Walmart way makes it that much easier for people who build to make stuff to sell to you, because they're already building systems and know how to talk to Walmart. Now they know how to build systems and know how to talk to you the same way. And that's how, you know, again, RSS evolved very similarly, as opposed to Atom, which is evolving in a more, you know, industry standardization kind of fashion. And it isn't to say one is better than the other, but both happen.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to watch. That's a good example, though, of stuff that CTOs have to sit around and, go, and you know, right. worry about and architect and decide on. And,
right.
You know, you have to take a step or take a stance. Hey, my company is going to be bad on .NET or Java, or it's going to be bad on RSS or Atom, or it's going to be bad on... RFID...
Right.
Machine.
But again, what typically happens is it's not as much. So a customer that shall remain nameless... I was talking to about 2 weeks ago, and they were telling me about how they picked one of our Java competitors, who I will also remain nameless, as their strategic platform a few years ago, and it's not working out for them. And so they came to an executive briefing at Microsoft to talk about, among other things, .NET, because they made a strategic decision around Java, and they're not happy with it. Now, does this mean that everybody's going to be unhappy with Java? No. But this one company in particular was not happy with Java.
Yeah.
And so they're looking at talking about us. But are they out of business because of it? No. You know, are they as effective as they might be if they were using Windows and .NET? I don't think they're as effective as they could be. But I'm biased, right? but
you know, you drink the Kool-Aid, man.
I make the Kool-Aid. What are you talking about? No, just kidding. As I said, I tend to have a different view of it, right? I'm not talking about this stuff from a technology for technology's sake perspective,
yeah.
right? I mean, in the reality is that if you look at the whole picture, I don't think we do a very good job telling the story, but I think we do a very good job of covering the whole picture,
yeah.
right? I mean, we do a lot of talking in this group around smart clients, and you were talking a second ago about the Wi-Fi-enabled Salesforce, as I kick your camera, sorry about that.
Yeah.
The Wi-Fi-enabled Salesforce. Well, you know, if you're going to do the Wi-Fi-enabled Salesforce, you know what an incredibly important part of that is smart client.
Yeah.
Because I may be on Wi-Fi now, and as soon as I drive 20 minutes away from wherever I was, I suddenly am no longer on the wireless network. How am I going to get access to that information?
Yeah.
So, you know, the ability to address the client is something that, you know, obviously Microsoft's in a pretty good position to help with and to take advantage of. I mean, I'm a big believer in some types of applications should be web apps, and Ajax is all well and good, but the reality is that, you know, there's some applications that are better as a smart client. I use the example of Microsoft. If I'm a sales rep and I'm out in the field all day where I don't necessarily know I'm going to have wireless access or network access, then I want something that's going to cache things locally. But by the same token, you know, I use the benefits application of Microsoft, well, typically once a year, plus the twice when my children were born, and the one time when I got married, right? So, you know, in 6.5 years, that's, you know, 9 times.
Yeah.
So is it really valuable to make that a smart client? Probably not.
No.
So, but it may make sense to make it, you know, Ajax in some cases, depending on the nature of the app.
Yeah.
So, but there's no chance I'm going to use that disconnected.
Now, what kind of resources does Microsoft give architects? I know... You helped do the Architect Developer Journal, or whatever you call
it. Architect's Journal, as he pulls it out of the round filing cabinet behind him. I have several copies of this. So this is the new form file of the journal. So Journal actually started in the UK.
So
modeling these now. Journal actually started in the UK with the UK sub, a gentleman named Arvindra Semi, who has been the brainchild behind Journal. All we've done in this group is actually take it and run with it. Before our marketing lead joined the team in October, we would basically print up several thousand copies of this and hope we could hand them out, which wasn't a very effective way to, you know, get the message out. This content is all online, so if you go to the website, Microsoft.com/architecture, you can actually get all the content from Journal, but we figured people want to get a paper copy, so we've actually moved to this new sort of 8.5 by 11 file format. I actually like the big format. But this is actually significantly cheaper to print, as it turns out.
Yep.
This was actually in everybody's bag at TechEd. So if you went
and
to TechEd,
probably distribute too, because that's hard to mail. That,
yeah, that's
that actually could be mailed. You know.
Right. Well, this folds in half. That's, it even has the little, like, you know, little hole there in the side so you can fold it. Anyway,
yeah.
But the point is that we're moving to this format, and Journal 5 I think is going to be online only, but then Journal 6 I think we're going to start, hopefully at that point, at some point. We're going to start shipping these out. And so you'll actually, if you go to the new architecture site, which is another thing Microsoft provides, Microsoft.com/architecture, you can actually sign up for a free subscription to Journal. So
okay.
You'll get this quarterly. It's when we publish it. So.
And what kind of articles do you put in? Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, we're trying to address across, you know, all three categories around strategic architects, solution architects, and infrastructure architects. So if you look at sort of the best of article, I have to look because even though I picked these articles, I don't remember what they were. You know, understanding service-oriented architecture, service-oriented architecture considerations for agile systems, business process decomposition and service identification using communications patterns, and secrets of great architects. So, I mean, these are obviously, you know, very sort of higher-level conceptual articles many times. You know, this is not the same kind of content you'd see in MSDN, right?
Right.
Though there was
what's the secret of a great architect?
I don't know. Let's read the article. What does Don say?
So, oh, it's a Don Box thing?
No, different Don. It's Donald Walt. Abstraction, the core principles of when applying levels of abstraction. You know, you can read this online, so. abstraction is a key, actually, when it comes to dealing with complexity in general. So, and that's part of what software factories is. It's what modeling is about. A lot of what we talk about in architectures around, you know, when you deal with, you know, the database at the level of abstraction that, you know, it stores data and manages transactions, and then the specifics of whether it's Oracle, DB2, or SQL Server are get to be more implementation details.
Right.
There's things you can reason about a relational database without really getting into the specifics of which platform or which product you're specifically picking.
Right.
So, it's been a while since I read the article. Yeah, thanks for putting me on the spot again.
Hey, you know.
Anyway, so we do the new website is Microsoft.com/architecture.
Yep.
We've always had a site on MSDN, or we've had it for a very long time at least. And so this new one on Microsoft.com, and at some point we hope to have some site that addresses the needs of infrastructure architects, but not yet.
Okay.
So we just launched that right actually before TechEd, so that's pretty cool.
What did you do at TechEd, by the way?
I sat around and talked to customers. I went to one set. I own the architecture track, so I'm the guy that picks the sessions that go on the track. I'm the guy that goes to a lot of meetings to figure out, you know, what's going on and sends email to our speakers like, hey, don't forget your session, get your PowerPoints in.
What session there got the most pop? What session were the
for my track?
Yeah.
The number one session this year, I think I did not look at the latest evals because obviously, you know, I look at them throughout the event. But I'm fairly certain that one of the best sessions is going to be Ron Jacobs from Patterns and Practices on patterns of service-oriented architecture. The DSL Tools Kit talk from Jakob Seaman, who's the PM of that team, that did very well. Smart Client Architecture with Rocky Lochta and Billy Hollis did extremely well. Code generation, architecting a new type of reuse. This is actually from one of my architect MVPs, a guy named Scott Hanselman. You may have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Scott actually is out there, you know, he's got a real world factory running today. It doesn't use nifty graphical tools because we haven't shipped nifty graphical tools yet. But I mean, he and I had a long chat about his talk, and I mean, as I said, I don't like to get all hung up on is this officially a factory or whatever. But I mean, he's built it, and he'll talk to you about it. In fact, his session I thought was phenomenal because he talks a lot about the real-world problem that his company was facing and the drivers that drove them down this path of doing a lot of code generation, a lot of, you know, building models. They're building models in XML rather than, you know, in XML schema rather than some other language.
Yeah.
But, I mean, essentially what they're doing is they're working at a higher level of abstraction and generating out all that lower-level code, which is really boring to write anyway.
Right.
And so, I mean, these are some of the talks I think did really well. We had a business talk, a business architecture talk later in the week that did pretty well. We did a real-world demo of a software factory, which I think I really liked. I think it could have gotten a little bit better eval, but, you know, I don't control that. we had Roger Sessions, who wrote, I don't think I have his book up here, and I don't. Sorry, it's at home, Roger.
Yeah.
But he wrote a book called Software Fortresses, which is extremely good. And so he posted. We had some really good stuff, I think. Yeah. Whereas it was also helpful this year that we actually have, like, some tools, right? So you could actually demo a software factory, and you could demo the DSL toolkit, and you could demo the...
And what's the DSL toolkit?
So DSL is the domain-specific languages. So this is the two things that are a big piece of software factories that we're going to be shipping soon. Right? So you made a comment earlier about how, you know, architects think 5 years off, but the reality is they have to address needs today. And so these are things we're shipping DSL tools and the guidance automation toolkit some period of time after Visual Studio 2005 ships. I'm not on the team, so I'm not going to commit them to any kind of timeline. But these are tools that are, you know, in beta today, or, well, they run on the beta of Visual Studio. So guidance automation is a templating system. It's more than that, but it's a long-winded explanation.
Yeah.
DSLs are domain-specific languages or modeling tools. And what's interesting is that one of the points that the software factories book makes is that we've done a lot of sort of horizontal improvements to tools and languages. And to get significantly more productivity, we're going to have to get domain-specific. Improving productivity for web apps will not help Windows apps.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. And what's fascinating is, of course, there's a modeling tool that everybody who's ever built an application with Visual Studio has used, which is the visual graphical layout of the user interface.
Yeah.
Right? This has been in Visual Basic since, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You have a modeling tool for laying out a user interface. I have 1 minute left. Okay.
Yeah.
So you have a modeling tool for laying out your user interface.
Yeah.
And it's a tool. You can't use it to do anything else, but it really makes laying out a user interface very fast and relatively painless. And so that kind of approach, being able to build domain-specific languages for other types of domains other than just user interface, that's the toolkit. And that and the guidance automation toolkit are our big sort of software factories down payments, as Jack likes to say, going forward. So,
well, thanks for spending almost an hour with us.
No, no problem, man.
This was fun.
Anytime. We need to get you around to some of the other guys on this team.
Oh, yeah. Well, someday give us a tour.
That's fine. Yeah. Well, maybe next time.
Are you coming to the PDC?
I'm planning on going to PDC. I'm hoping to speak at the PDC. We'll see what actually happens.
All right.
I'm not helping plan PDC because I'm on paternity leave. All right. So.
Well, hope we can all see you there.
Yeah, cool thing.
Well, thanks a lot.
No, see you later, man.
Bye.